ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Monday, the 24th of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, a gold-plated toilet and bags of cash. Ukraine faces a corruption scandal and pressure to sign a peace deal widely seen as pro-Russian. And what does the first two-day Ashes test in more than 100 years mean for the normally five-day test match series?
A win for Australia.
I still think we like our test matches to teach us about life a little bit, about boring ideas like patience and accountability and discipline. And I think that there's a lot of people who have watched this England performance thinking if only they applied some test cricket principles, they might be successful as well.
Thousands of people remain without power in Darwin and the Tiwi Islands after Tropical Cyclone Fina moved through the NT over the weekend as a Category 3 storm. Residents in Western Australia's far north are now being warned to expect damaging winds and heavy rain as Fina approaches the Kimberley. Here's Luke Radford.
After an intense weekend of heavy winds and rain, the cleanup is underway in Darwin after Cyclone Fina moved along the Northern Territory coast. Locals like Tierney White are shaken but unharmed.
Just hearing a bang and just not knowing where it had come from, you're like, where has that hit? Has it hit the house? Has it hit something? You know, we're lucky because we did put the cars away, so that was a good thing. So our cars are fine, but they're trapped in there. We can't move anywhere, which is quite funny.
Leah Finocchiaro is the NT's chief minister.
There is devastation everywhere in the sense of we have huge trees down on people's homes, blocking their driveways. For example, we have 18 major traffic intersections that are still without power and about 15,000 homes who will be waking up this morning for the second time without power.
Leah Finocchiaro says there are no reported fatalities or serious injuries and no major infrastructure appears to have been lost.
People are really relieved. They feel lucky, and I think that preparation work that we did incredibly early, we've been watching this closely since it was a low and the public messaging has been strong and people were very much heeding the messages of our authorities. And so I think people feel that we got through it as a community.
Fina is the earliest cyclone on record to make landfall in the Northern Territory. It's also the strongest storm to hit Darwin since Cyclone Tracy in 1974, which devastated the city and killed more than 60 people. Darwin resident Victoria Geraghty says Fina created a lot of stress among locals like her, who survived Cyclone Tracy.
It just builds up and then you feel as if you can't go any further. But the anxieties, you don't think you're going to get it, but I think I've been through Marcus after Tracy and there's about four other small ones, but just having the anxiety build up and just hit you.
Part of a ceiling on the first floor of the Royal Darwin Hospital collapsed on Sunday, but all hospitals and medical centres in Darwin and on the Tiwi Islands remain operational. However, there are still power outages across Darwin and the Tiwi Islands, which bore the brunt of the weekend storm. Mike Besselink is the General Manager of the NT Power and Water Corporation.
We do have to prioritise where we're going, and certainly, our focus is on getting, large numbers of customers and backbones, what we call the electrical backbone, back into service so that we can get large number of customers back on, and we will be working through that priority as we go forward.
Meanwhile, Fina has continued westwards, gaining strength to become a Category 4 cyclone as it approaches the Kimberley. While the storm is expected to weaken as it crosses the coast, residents in Cambridge Gulf to north of Berkeley River Lodge are being urged to shelter indoors. Todd Pender from the Department of Fire and Emergency Services says they've sent additional resources to the main town in the region, Kalumburu.
That was one of the areas that was potentially going to have landfall. So we've put some staff in there working with the local community, working with local police and some of the groups there. And that is just, that also gives us, it's a presence in town. So it's just there to reassure everybody.
Fina's arrival has caught some locals off guard. Todd Shield is the general manager of the Mungalalu North Kimberley Airport.
We sort of at this time of the year are ramping up for cyclone season, which means that we tend to bring more stocks, more fuel stocks, food stocks, those sort of things into the airport. So we've only just started that process. So we're not fully prepared for it from that perspective. However, we're fine. We're in a good place.
Fina is expected to rapidly weaken and turn south after it crosses the WA coast.
Luke Radford. There's been more crunch time talks in Geneva over a US-backed 28-point plan to end the Russia-Ukraine war. But President Donald Trump has blasted Ukraine on social media, calling it ungrateful. And at home, Ukraine has been rocked by an ongoing corruption scandal featuring a gold-plated toilet and bags of cash. Nicole Johnston reports.
There's been frantic diplomacy in Geneva. Top diplomats from the US, Ukraine, the UK, France and Germany in the Swiss capital to discuss two major peace plans. US President Donald Trump wasn't there, and he wasn't happy with Ukraine, posting this message on Truth Social.
Ukraine's leadership has expressed zero gratitude for our efforts, and Europe continues to buy oil from Russia.
President Zelensky was upbeat about the progress of the talks.
Today, the negotiations in Switzerland will continue, and the teams will be working practically until night. It is important that there is dialogue with the American representatives, and there are signals President Trump's team is hearing us.
The US has put forward a 28-point peace plan. Under it, Ukraine would have to withdraw its troops from Donetsk province and limit the size of its army. The country would not be allowed to join NATO. US Secretary of State Marco Rubio said President Trump will be pleased with the progress and that Russia will be consulted next.
Well, obviously the Russians get a vote here, right? So, I mean, look, no matter what we came up with today, obviously we now have to take what we come up with if we can reach that agreement with the Ukrainian side to the Russian side. That's another part of this equation. They have to agree to this in order for this to work.
The US plan caught Europe and Ukraine off guard, with critics accusing it of being too pro-Russian. Yuri Sack is a former advisor to Ukraine's Ministry of Defence.
Europe is very concerned, and this is why Europe is very unanimous in sharing their dissatisfaction or disagreement with the 28 points plan as it was originally published. But again, we shouldn't probably be too worried at this stage yet, because as we have seen, that there are signs that the US administration understands the red lines that Ukraine has.
Mr. Sachs says Russia has red lines too.
It is not acceptable to the Kremlin, to their maximalistic expectations. Well, because, for example, you know, one of the provisions of the plan envisages that Russia will be paying rent for, you know, for being on the Ukrainian territory. So that's point number one. Point number two, according to that first draft of that peace plan, Ukraine's army was to be limited to 600,000 personnel. I don't think that would go down well with Russia anywhere, because in Istanbul they wanted 85,000.
At home, President Zelensky is dealing with a crisis, a huge corruption scandal. It's alleged senior officials stole millions of dollars from the state nuclear company.
The Minister of Energy, for example, was involved, and he's now dismissed and under investigation. The Minister of Justice was involved, and he has been dismissed.
Has it shaken people in Ukraine to have this level of corruption out in the open?
People are very, very disappointed, of course, to have learned about this level of corruption. But at the same time, we remain united in the face of the threat that there is coming from Russia.
Mr. Zelensky is under pressure. Ukrainian investigators found a gold-plated toilet bowl in a flat owned by Timur Mindik, one of the president's former business partners. And more heads could roll.
We have not seen all of the tapes yet. And, you know, when tomorrow comes, more tapes can be published and we'll hear more names.
Former ministerial advisor Yuri Sark, ending that report by Nicole Johnston. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Back home, and a parliamentary standoff is looming as the Environment Minister warns the Coalition and the Greens it's now or never in the government's bid to pass changes to environmental laws. Murray Watt says there's still room to negotiate and is adamant the laws will be passed this week. Tanya Dendrinos.
It's the final sitting week of the year in federal parliament, and negotiations are running hot on updates to environmental laws. Murray Watt is the Minister for the Environment and Water.
I had some further meetings and discussions with both the Coalition and the Greens over the weekend, and that has definitely narrowed the issues on both sides for debate this week. I'm in under no doubt that we will pass these laws this week. It's really a matter of whether it's with the Coalition or the Greens.
It's been 5 years since an independent review of the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act found it's not fulfilling its objectives, but finding common ground among political rivals hasn't been easy.
I've said all along that what we want is a balanced package of reforms that delivers both to the environment and to the business community. It can't be one or the other, and both the Coalition and the Greens need to work out what are their absolute bottom lines and ensure that the final package that comes through this Parliament does deliver both environmental gains and business gains, and I think that's absolutely possible.
The Shadow Minister for the Environment, Angie Bell, says the ball is in the Minister's court, having raised numerous issues regarding the bill and what she calls coalition red lines.
Well, I think there is some problems around definitions and certainly unacceptable impacts and the window of definition, if you like, and also net gain. It is not clear what they actually are in the bills, and they are very, very important. Another substantial important area is the EPA, its powers. We want to make sure that the CEO is accountable to the minister and that there is a statement of expectation around that with KPIs attached, and so that the CEO of the new EPA is accountable and can be sacked by the minister. And at this point in time, that is not the case.
The Greens are calling for an end to native forest logging. The government says that won't be happening, but has offered concessions. Meanwhile, on the international stage, a divisive COP30 climate summit came to an end in Brazil over the weekend. Countries agreed to scale up finance for developing nations to cope with the impacts of climate change, but the major sticking point was the failure to directly address a move away from fossil fuels. Tom Woodruff is a senior international fellow with the Smart Energy Council and a former climate diplomat who worked on the Paris Agreement. He was in Belém for the summit.
There's no getting around the fact that it's a disappointing outcome. A few years ago in Dubai, the world agreed to transition away from fossil fuels. And there was a huge constituency of countries, in the end, almost 90 countries, including Australia, that were hopeful that in Belém would be able to secure some much more concrete language around phasing out fossil fuels and indeed to begin a process to set a timeline or, in their words, a roadmap to do just that.
A side text, the Belém Declaration for the Transition Away from Fossil Fuels, was instead announced and signed by more than 20 countries, including Australia. Jacqueline Peel, a professor of law from the University of Melbourne, was also at the summit.
Sort of a coalition of the willing emerged who said, look, well, we still want to take forward this action. We'll agree in our smaller group to take forward a fossil fuel roadmap that'll be outside the negotiation process, but can still at least help us start on this important thing for climate action.
It marks the strongest language on phasing out fossil fuels Australia has ever supported, but the government has been criticised by some campaigners who argue the move is hollow rhetoric, given the government's ongoing support for gas production.
Tanya Dendrinos. There's more evidence today that life is getting harder for children. A survey of kids, along with analysis of 100 major data sets, shows rising anxiety about future housing and financial security. And among younger children, only 53% are starting school developmentally on track, as Annie Guest reports.
Growing up in a community-minded family, 17-year-old Brisbane resident Sarah Bunbury embraces volunteering. At the Australian-based charity Gen Z Abroad, she hears a lot of young people's worries.
I mean, the cost of living crisis is super, super concerning for a lot of us. We're looking at the job market and the housing market, and there's a lot of concern about, can I get a job? Are we then going to be able to afford a house? Are we then going to be able to afford to keep up with the ever-increasing, like, cost of living crisis? And I think people are just really concerned about the way that things are like headed.
Sarah Bunbury says many are trying hard to tackle the problem.
I have friends who are working hours upon hours a week. They're getting like 5 maybe hours of sleep a night because they've got to like go straight from school to work, and then they get home from work at midnight. They're going to burn themselves out, and they're not even an adult yet. And also, like, there's students that are dropping out of school at 15 to go work at Woolies to support their families.
Kids' financial concerns are echoed in the inaugural State of Australia's Children Report by UNICEF and the Australian Research Alliance for Children and Youth, with funding support from the Mindaroo Foundation. Co-author Nicole Breeze from UNICEF says they found housing and financial security the top issues for 43% of young people.
Only one in three had a sense of hopefulness or optimism about the next 5 years. The most significant thing on the minds of teenagers and young people across Australia is financial security and housing.
Researchers surveyed 2,500 teenagers and also worked with 3 to 11-year-olds to gather information. And they analysed more than 100 sources of data, including from the Census and Institute of Health and Welfare. Nicole Breeze says 47% of young people weren't on track in their physical and intellectual development by school.
An increasing number of five-year-olds are reaching school age assessed as not developmentally ready across one or more of the five key domains. And that's things like social competence, physical health, emotional maturity.
The report calls for the federal government to create a National Children's Act and also carry out last year's recommendation by the Productivity Commission for a National Early Childhood Commission, ensuring coordinated plans, targets and standards. The Minister for Early Childhood Education and Youth, Senator Jess Walsh, was unavailable for an interview. Meanwhile, youth working volunteer Sarah Bunbury at Gen Z Abroad tries to help young people learn more about managing money.
First thing we do is teach them how to lodge a tax return, because that is something that people need to be doing, and it's just not always something that they know how to do. And then we look at the impacts on investing or saving or doing whatever they want to do with their money.
She also says schools could do more to teach financial literacy.
Any guest there? Hezbollah has confirmed its top military commander was killed in an Israeli airstrike in Lebanon's capital city overnight. The chief of staff was one of at least five people killed in the strike on an apartment block in southern Beirut. Senior Hezbollah officials say the attack crossed a line, and it's considering whether the group will respond. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
In the southern suburbs of Beirut, residents rush out of apartment buildings. It's the first strike by Israel on Lebanon's capital in months, bombing an apartment building, killing five people and wounding at least 25 others. Hezbollah confirming its most senior commander, Haitham Ali Tabatabahi, is among those dead. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says it was a targeted attack, ordered by his government to fulfil its obligation to disarm the powerful militant group, Hezbollah.
Israel Defence Forces eliminated Haitham Tabatabahi, Hezbollah's terror organisation chief of staff. Tabatabahi is a mass murderer. His hands are filled with blood of many Israelis and Americans. I thank Israel Defence Forces and security forces who carried out a professional, precise and successful operation today.
Israel and Hezbollah have been trading attacks back and forth since the war in Gaza began, but their conflict has been ongoing since the 1970s. Mahmoud Qamati is deputy leader of Hezbollah's political council.
This attack today on the southern suburbs crosses a new red line. Hezbollah's leadership is studying the matter of response and will take the appropriate decision. The strike on the southern suburbs today opens the door to an escalation of assaults all over Lebanon.
US President Donald Trump has been pushing for Hezbollah's disarmament, putting pressure on the Lebanese government to do more. The day before the attack, he told reporters the US is working with Lebanon on the issue.
Hezbollah has been a problem in Lebanon, big problem. We're working with Lebanon. We're working with everybody in the Middle East.
Dr. Ali Mamouri is a Middle East analyst from Deakin University. He says there's been unconfirmed reports the Iran-backed militant group is finding ways to increase its military capability.
The guy that was targeted is a senior commander. He's a very important figure. Israel attempted to kill him 2 times ago. In the past, there have been some reports as well that his name is affiliated with the party attempt to rearm and to increase its military capability. So it's all coming in that context.
Dr. Marmouri says the attack was a clear breach of the ceasefire agreement struck last year between Israel and Hezbollah. But he doesn't think Hezbollah is in a position to retaliate.
I don't think we're going to have further escalation from Hezbollah side. However, continuing this behavior from Israel would probably take the region to further escalation and to unknown situation in general. The matter is a long-term matter, and it won't. It's not expected to get solved soon.
In a statement, Lebanon's President Joseph Aoun condemned the strike and accused Israel of refusing to implement its end of the ceasefire agreement. He also called on the international community to intervene with strength and seriousness to stop the attacks on Lebanon and its people.
Kathleen O'Connor and Alison Shaw with that report. Australia's stunning two-day Ashes win in Perth has reportedly cost Cricket Australia more than $3 million in foregone ticket sales, as England's more aggressive playing style, dubbed Bazball, proved unsuccessful. The fast cricket technique did help draw record ratings for television broadcasters. So, is this new wave of cricket a headache for the traditionalists, or will it bring a legion of new fans to the test match format? Kemble Price reports.
For Australia, a remarkable win, a memorable win, perhaps a famous win.
It was the shortest Ashes test match in more than a century, with two innings complete in just 2 days in Perth. Barmy Army fans were left stumped.
Can I ask you what you thought of last night's game?
Brilliant, yeah, wonderful, wasn't it? Not.
England brought its aggressive Bazball playing style to Perth, and the result spoke for itself.
I wouldn't like to say exactly what it was, but it just sort of, to me, I mean, I have seen a lot of test matches, and it was just totally different to anything I've seen before.
They seem obsessed with this Bazball, you know, play without fear. That's a funny concept, because if you go out there and you play without fear, you hit the first ball and you get caught, then there's no consequences.
Bazball is named after England's coach Brendan Baz McCullum, and it's leading many punters to believe the test format is evolving. Liam Hauser is a sports journalist and cricket writer.
Basically, it's about taking the attack to the opposition, especially when batting, and looking to score runs at a very fast rate, rather than being patient and trying to build things.
In recent years, there's been a decline in attendance and viewers for Test cricket, with shorter one-day and Big Bash matches proving popular. But Liam Hauser thinks the Bazball style could draw more fans to the long-form game.
And even if the traditionalists are turned off by it, I think the people who are more into the T20 stuff, well, then they might come on board with the Test cricket a bit more. I mean, even though I'm more of a traditionalist in cricket, I mean, I watched nearly all of the 2 days, and it was certainly very entertaining.
Cricket author and podcaster Sam Perry believes Test cricket remains at the heart of the sport.
I still think we like our Test matches to teach us about life a little bit, about, you know, boring ideas like patience and accountability and discipline. And I think that there's a lot of people who have watched this England performance thinking if only they applied some Test cricket principles, they might be successful as well.
But the rapid-fire Ashes opener didn't just cause headaches for the England side. It's also proving costly for Cricket Australia, with foregone ticket sales estimating a loss of more than $3 million. Warwick Hadfield is a sports commentator with ABC Radio National.
It certainly gets people talking. The people who would be talking the most right now would be Cricket Australia, because they've missed out on 3 days' revenue. And, of course, as we know, they're their finances are not entirely looking flash, and they usually bank on an Ashes tour to bolster their finances.
On the other hand, cricket broadcaster Foxtel recorded their most watched day one of a first test in history, and a record number of people packed into Perth Stadium over the 2 days. Warwick Hadfield believes people's interest in cricket is picking up, and Travis Head's century for the Aussies kept viewers entertained.
Guides it!
It was an astonishing innings. It's in the history of the game, or in the imagery of the game, if you like. You know, Jumper dancing down the pitch, that famous photograph, and perhaps Arthur Morris and Don Bradman shaking hands after their 404 at Headingley.
England will get a chance at redemption at the second Ashes test beginning on December 4.
Kimberly Price and Bridget Fitzgerald with that report. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Our peak scientific body has invented a lot, like where would we be without Wi-Fi? But once again, the CSIRO is axing jobs. Today, author, comedian and ambassador for mathematics and science at Sydney Uni, Adam Spencer, on what happens when we slash science funding. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.